Young Holy Father, I cannot go alone in the darkness, devils will get me. Will you lead me back to my camp? He implored. I am under the instruction of the venerable hermit, replied the young man. I will go if he will permit. My priestly robe will protect me from the perils of the night. The old hermit chuckled as he gave the permission. The thin young monk led the way out of the cave. The towering giant of a trader followed, reeking of yak wool and worse. Just by the entrance he chanced to brush against a leafy branch. There was a squawk as a frightened bird was dislodged from its perch. The trader uttered a terrified screech, and fell fainting at the feet of the young monk. Ow! Young Holy Father, sobbed the trader, I thought the devils had got me at last. I almost, but not quite, decided to give back the money I took from the Indian money lenders. You saved me, you beat off the devils. Get me safe to my camp and I will give you a half brick of tea and a whole bag of tsanpa. This was an offer too good to miss, so the young monk put on a special show by reciting the prayers to the dead, the exhortation to unrestful spirits, and a chant to the guardians of the way. The resulting uproar, for the young monk was very unmusical, scared away all the creatures who roamed by night whatever it did to any chance devils. At last they reached the campfire where others of the trader's party were singing and playing musical instruments while the women were grinding up tea bricks and dropping the results into a bubbling cauldron of water. A whole bag of finely ground barley was stirred in and then one old woman reached a claw-like hand into a bag and withdrew it holding a fistful of yak butter. Into the cauldron it went, another, and yet another until the fat oozed and frothed on the surface. The glow of the firelight was inviting, the pleasure of the trading party infectious. The young monk folded his robe decorously around him and sedately sat on the ground. An aged crone, with chin almost touching nose, hospitably held out her hand. The young monk self-consciously proffered his bowl and a generous helping of tea and tsanpa was ladled in. In the thin mountain air boiling was not 100 degrees centigrade. Nor 212 Fahrenheit, but bearable to the mouth. The whole party set to with gusto and soon there was a procession to the lake waters so that the bowl could be washed and scoured afresh in the fine river sand. The river feeding the lake brought the finest sand from higher in the mountain range, sand which frequently was flecked with gold. The party was merry. The stories of the traders many, and their music and songs brought color to the young man's rather dull existence. But the moon climbed higher, lighting the barren landscape with her silvery glow and casting shadows with stark reality. The sparks from the fire no longer rose in clouds, the flames died low. Reluctantly the young monk rose to his feet and with many bows of thanks accepted the gifts thrust upon him by the trader, who was sure the young man had saved him from perdition. At last, laden with little packages, he stumbled along by the lake, to the right through the small grove of willows and on to where the mouth of the cave glowered black and forbidding. He stopped beside the entrance for a moment and looked up at the sky. Far, far above, as if approaching the door of the gods, a bright flame sailed silently across the sky. A chariot of the gods, or what? The young monk wandered briefly, and entered the cave. Chapter 2. The lowing of yaks and excited shouts from men and women roused the young monk. Sleepily rising to his feet he drew his robe around him and made for the entrance to the cave, determined not to miss any excitement. By the lake men were milling, trying to harness yaks which stood in the water and could not be persuaded to come out. At last, losing his patience, a young trader dashed into the water and tripped over a submerged root. Arms aflail he fell face down with a resounding smack. Great gouts of water splashed up and the yaks, now frightened, lumbered ashore. The young trader, covered in slimy mud and looking extremely foolish, scrambled ashore to the hoots of laughter from his friends. Soon the tents were rolled up, the cooking utensils, well burnished by sand, packed and the whole trading caravan moved slowly off to the monotonous creaking of harness and the shouts of men in vain trying to urge more speed from the ponderous animals. Sadly, the young monk stood with hands shading his eyes from the rising sun's glare. Sadly, he stood and stared into the distance long after the noise had ceased. Oh, why, he thought, could not he have been a trader and travel to far-off places? Why did he always have to study things which no one else seemed to have to study? He wanted to be a trader, or a boatman on the Happy River. He wanted to move round, go places and see things. Little did he know then that he would go places and see things until his body craved peace and his soul ached for rest. Little did he think then that he would wander the face of the earth and suffer unbelievable torments. Now he just wanted to be a trader, or a boatman, anything but what he was. Slowly, with downcast head, he picked up the betwigged branch and re-entered the cave to sweep the floor and strew fresh sand. The old hermit slowly appeared. Even to the inexperienced gaze of the younger man he was visibly failing. With a gasp he settled himself and croaked, "My time is approaching, but I cannot leave until I have given you all the knowledge that is mine. Here are special and very potent herbal drops given to me by your very famous guide for just such an occasion. Should I collapse, and you fear for my life, force 6 drops into my mouth and I shall revive. I am forbidden to leave my body until I have finished my task." He fumbled in his robes and produced a little stone bottle which the younger monk took with the greatest care. "Now we will continue," said the old man. "You can eat when I am tired and have to rest a while. Now, listen, and take the greatest care to remember. Let not your attention wander, for this is worth more than my life and worth more than yours. It is knowledge to be preserved and passed on when the time is ripe." After resting for some moments he appeared to regain strength, and a little color crept back to his cheeks. Settling himself rather more comfortably, he said, "You will have remembered all I have told you so far. Let us, then, continue." The discussion was prolonged and, in my opinion, very heated, but eventually the babble of conversation ended. There was much shuffling of many feet, then footsteps, small light footsteps like that of a bird tripping along to a grub. Heavy footsteps, ponderous as the lumbering walk of a heavily laden yak. Footsteps which puzzled me profoundly, for some of them seemed to be not made by humans such as I knew. But my thoughts on the matter of footsteps were suddenly ended. A hand grasped me by the arm and a voice said, "Come with us." Another hand grasped my other arm and I was led up a path which to my bare feet felt as though it were metal. The blind develop other senses. I sensed that we were traversing some sort of metal tube, although how that could be I could not possibly imagine. The old man stopped as though to picture again in his mind that unforgettable experience, then he continued, "Soon we reached a more spacious area as I could determine by the changed echoes. There was a metallic sliding sound in front of me, and one of the men leading me spoke in a very respectful voice to someone obviously very superior to him. What was said I have no means of knowing, for it was said in a peculiar language, a language of pipings and chirps. In answer to what was evidently an older, I was pushed forward and the metallic substance slid shut with a soft thunk behind me. I stood there feeling the gaze of someone staring hard. There was a rustle of fabric and the creak of what I imagined to be a seat similar to that which had seated me. Then a thin and bony hand took my right hand and led me forward." The hermit paused briefly and chuckled. "Can you imagine my feelings? I was in a living miracle. I knew not what was before me and had to trust without hesitation those who led me. This person at last spoke to me in my own language. 'Sit here,' he said, at the same time pushing me gently down. I gasped with horror and fright. I felt as though falling into a bed of feathers. Then the seat, or whatever it was, gripped me most intimately where I was not used to being gripped. At the sides there were struts, or arms, presumably designed to prevent one from falling off if one slept through the strange softness. The person facing me seemed most amused at my reactions, I could tell from an ill-suppressed laugh, but many people seem to derive amusement from the plight of those who cannot see. 'You feel strange and afraid,' said the voice of the person opposite me. That definitely was an understatement. Be not alarmed, he continued, for you will not be harmed in any way. Our tests show that you have a most eidetic memory, so you are going to have information, which you will never forget, and which you will much later pass on to another who will come your way. It all seemed mysterious and very frightening in spite of the assurances. I said nothing but sat quietly and waited for the next remarks, which were not long in coming. You are going to see, continued the voice, all the past, the birth of your world, the origin of gods, and why chariots flame across the sky to your great concern. Respected sir, I exclaimed, you use the word see, but my eyes have been removed, I am blind, I have no sight at all. There was a muttered exclamation indicative of exasperation and the rejoinder with some asperity. We know all about you, more than you will ever know. Your eyes have been removed, but the optic nerve is still there. With our science we can connect to the optic nerve and you will see what we want you to see. Will that mean that I shall permanently have sight again? I asked. No, it will not, came the reply. We are using you for a purpose. To permanently give you sight would be to let you loose upon this world with a device far in advance of this world's science, and that is not permitted. Now, enough talk, I will summon my assistants. Soon there came a respectful knock followed by the metallic sliding noise. There was a conversation, evidently two people had entered. I felt my seat moving and tried to jump up. To my horror I felt that I was completely restrained. I could not move, not even so much as a finger. Fully conscious I was moved along in this strange seat which appeared to slide easily in any direction. We moved along passageways where the echoes gave me many strange impressions. Eventually there came a sharp turn to the seat and most remarkable doors assailed my twitching nostrils. We stopped at a muttered command and hands grasped me by the legs and under the shoulders. Easily I was lifted straight up, to the side, and down. I was alarmed, terrified would be a more correct word. That terror increased when a tight band was placed around my right arm just above the elbow. The pressure increased so that it felt as though my arm was swelling. Then came a prick to my left ankle and a most extraordinary sensation as if something was being slid inside me. A further command was given and at my temples I felt two ice-cold discs. There was a buzz as of a bee droning in the distance, and I felt my consciousness fading away. Bright flashes of flame flickered across my vision. Streaks of green, red, purple, all colors. Then I screamed, I had no vision, I must therefore be in the land of the devils and they were preparing torments for me. A sharp stab of pain, just a pinprick, really, and my terror subsided. I just did not care, anymore. A voice spoke to me in my own language, saying, be not afraid. We are not going to hurt you. We are now adjusting so that you will see. What color do you see now? So I forgot my fear while I said when I saw red, when I saw green, and all other colors. Then I yelled with astonishment, I could see, but that which I could see was so strange that I could scarce comprehend any of it. But how does one describe the indescribable? How does one endeavor to picture a scene to another when in one's language there are no words which are appropriate, when there are no concepts which might fit the case? Here in our Tibet we are well provided with words and phrases devoted to gods and devils, but when one comes to dealing with the works of gods or devils, I don't know which, what can one do, what can one say, how can one picture? I can only say that I saw. But my sight was not in the location of my body, and with my sight I could see myself. It was a most unnerving experience, an experience which I never want to repeat, but let me start at the beginning. One of the voices had asked me to say when I saw red, to say when I saw green and other colors, and then there was this terrific experience, this white, stupendous flash, and I found that I was gazing, for that is the only word which seems appropriate, at a scene entirely alien to everything I had known. I was reclining, half lying, half sitting, propped up on what seemed to be a metallic platform. It seemed to be supported on one solitary pillar, and I was for a moment very afraid that the whole device would topple over, and me with it. The general atmosphere was of such cleanliness that I had never known. The walls, of some shiny material, were spotless. They were a greenish tinge, very pleasant, very soothing. About this strange room, which was a very large room indeed according to my standards, there were massive pieces of equipment which I just cannot tell you about because there are no words which would in any way convey their strangeness to you. But the people in that room, that gave me a stupendous shock, that gave me a shock that almost set me off raving and screaming, and then I thought perhaps this is just a distortion, caused by some trick of this artificial vision which they had given, no, lent, to me. There was a man standing by the side of some machine. I judged that he was about twice the height of our biggest proctors. I should say he was about 14 feet high, and he had the most extraordinary conical shaped head, a head which went up almost like the small end of an egg. He was completely hairless, and he was immense. He seemed to be clad in some kind of greenish robe. They were all covered in green cloth, by the way, which reached from his neck right down to his ankles, and, extraordinary thought, covered the arms as far as the wrists. I was horrified to look at the hands and find that there was a sort of skin over them. As I gazed from one to the other, they all had this strange coating on the hands, and I wondered what the religious significance of that could be, or did they think that I was unclean and they might catch something from me? My gaze wandered from this giant. There were two whom I should judge by their contours to be female. One was very dark, and one was very light. One had a type of kinky hair, while the other had a straight sort of white hair. But I never have been experienced in the matter of females, and so that is a subject which we should not discuss, nor should it interest you. The two females were gazing at me, and then one moved her hand in the direction at which I had not yet looked. There I saw a most extraordinary thing, a dwarf, a gnome, a very, very small body, a body like that of a five-year-old child, I thought. But the head, the head was immense, a great dome of a skull, hairless, too, not a trace of hair anywhere in sight on this one. The chin was small, very small indeed, and the mouth was not a mouth the same as we have, but seemed to be more of a triangular orifice. The nose was slight, not a protuberance so much as a ridge. This was obviously the most important person because the others looked with such deferential respect in his direction. But then this female moved her hand again, and a voice from a person whom I had not before noticed spoke in my own language saying, "Look forward, do you see yourself?" With that the speaker came into my range of vision. He seemed to be the most normal. He seemed to be, well, I should say that dressed up he could appear as a trader, perhaps an Indian trader, so you know how normal he was. He walked forward and pointed to some very shiny substance. I gazed at it, at least I suppose I did, but my sight was outside of my body. I had no eyes, so where had they put the thing which was seeing for me? And then I saw, on a little platform attached to this strange metal bench on which I reclined, I saw a form of box. I was on the point of wondering how I could see the thing if it was that with which I was seeing, when it occurred to me that the thing in front, the shiny thing, was some form of reflector. The most normal man moved that reflector slightly, altered its angle or tilt, and then I did shout with horror and consternation because I saw myself lying upon the platform. I had seen myself before my eyes were taken from me. At times when I had gone to the water's edge and gone to drink, I had seen my reflection in the placid stream, and so I could recognize myself. But here, in this reflecting surface, I saw an emaciated figure looking almost at the point of death. There was a band around an arm, and a band around an ankle. Strange tubes came from those bands to where I saw not. But a tube protruded from a nostril, and that went to some transparent bottle, tied to a metal rod beside me. But the head, that I can hardly recollect and stay calm. From the head just above the forehead, protruded a number of pieces of metal with what seemed to be strings coming from those protrusions. The strings led mainly to the box which I had seen on the small metal platform beside me. I imagined that it was an extension of my optic nerve going to the black box, but I looked with increasing horror, and went to tear the things from me, and found I still could not move. I could not move at all, not a finger. I could just lie there and gaze at this strange thing that was happening to me. The normal-looking man put his hand out towards the black box, and had I been able to move I would have flinched violently. I thought he was poking his fingers in my sight, the illusion was so complete, but instead he moved the box a little and I had a different view. I could see around the back of the platform on which I rested, I could see two other people there. They looked fairly normal, one was white, the other was yellow as a Mongolian. They were just standing looking at me, not twinking, not taking any notice of me. They seemed rather bored with the whole affair, and I remember thinking then that if they were in my place they certainly would not have been bored. The voice spoke again, saying, "Well, this, for a short time, is your sight. These tubes will feed you, there are other tubes which will drain you and attend to other functions. For the present you will not be able to move, for we fear that if we do permit you to move you may, in frenzy, injure yourself. For your own protection you are immobilized. But fear not, no ill will befall you. When we have finished you will be returned to some other part of Tibet with your health improved, and you will be normal except that still you will have no eyes. You will understand that you could not go about carrying this black box." He smiled slightly in my direction, and stepped backwards out of the range of my vision. People moved about, checking various things. There were a number of strange circular things like little windows covered with the finest glass. But behind the glass there seemed to be nothing of importance except a little pointer which moved or pointed at certain strange marks. It all meant nothing to me. I gave it a cursory glance, but it was so completely beyond my comprehension that I dismissed the affair as something beyond my understanding. Time passed, and I lay there feeling neither refreshed nor tired, but almost in a state of stasis, rather without feeling. Certainly I was not suffering, certainly I was not so worried now. I seemed to feel a subtle change in my body chemistry, and then at the fringe of vision of this black box I saw that one person was turning various protrusions which came from a lot of glass stubbings or fitted to a metal frame. As the person turned these protrusions the little things behind the small glass windows made different pointings. The smallest man, whom I had regarded as a dwarf, but who, it seemed, was the one in charge, said something. And then into my range of vision came the one who spoke to me in my own language, telling me that now they would put me to sleep for a time so that I should be refreshed, and when I had had nourishment and sleep they would show me what it was that they had to show me. Barely had he finished speaking when my consciousness went again, as though switched off. Later I was to find that that indeed was the case. They had a device whereby instant and harmless unconsciousness could be induced at the flick of a finger. How long I slept, or was unconscious, I have no means of knowing. It could have been an hour, or even a day. My waking was as instantaneous as had been my sleeping. One instant I was unconscious, the next instant I was wide awake. To my profound regret my new sight was not in operation. I was as blind as before. Strange sounds assailed my ears, the clink of metal against metal, the tinkle of glass then swift footsteps receding. Came the sliding, metallic sound and all was quiet for a few moments. I lay there thinking, marveling at the strange events which had brought such turmoil to my life. Just as a prince iron and anxiety were welling strongly within me, there came a distraction. Clackety footsteps, short and staccato, came to my hearing. Two sets of them accompanied by the distant murmur of voices. The sound increased, and turned into my room. Again the metallic sliding, and the two females, for thus I determined them to be, came towards me still talking in their high nervous tones, both talking at the same time, or so it appeared to me. They stopped one on each side of me, then horror of horrors, they whipped away my solitary covering. There was not a thing I could do about it. Powerless, motionless I lay there at the mercy of these females. Naked, naked as the day when I was born. Naked before the gaze of these unknown women. Me, a monk who knew nothing of women, who, let me confess it freely, was terrified of women. The old hermit stopped. The young monk stared at him in horror, thinking of the terrible indignity of such an event. Upon the hermit's forehead a film of perspiration bedewed the tight skin as he relived the ghastly time. With shaking hands he reached out for his bowl which contained water. Taking a few sips, he set the bowl carefully back beside him. But worse was to follow, he faltered hesitatingly. The young females rolled me on my side and forced a tube into an unmentionable portion of my body. Liquid entered me and I felt I would burst. Then, without any ceremony at all, I was lifted and a very cold container was placed below my nether regions. I must in modesty refrain from describing what happened next in front of those females. But that was merely a start. They washed my naked body all over and showed a most shameless familiarity with the private parts of the male body. I grew hot all over and was covered with the utmost confusion. Sharp rods of metal were pushed into me and the tube from my nostrils was snatched out and a fresh one forced roughly in. Then a cloth was drawn over me from my neck to below my feet. Still they were not finished. There came a painful tearing at my scalp and many inexplicable things happened before a very sticky, irritating substance was plastered on. All the while the young females chattered away and giggled as though devils had stolen their brains. After much time there came again the metallic slither and heavier footsteps approached, whereat the chatter of the females ceased. The voice in my own language greeted me, "And how are you now?" "Terrible," I replied with feeling. "Your females stripped me naked and abused my body in a manner too shocking to credit." He appeared to derive intense amusement from my remarks. In fact, to be quite candid, he hooted with laughter which did nothing to soothe my feelings. "We had to have you washed," he said, "we had to have your body cleaned of waste and we had to feed you by the same method. Then the various tubes and electric connections had to be replaced with sterilized ones. The incision in your skull had to be inspected and redressed. There will be only faint scars when you leave here." The old hermit bent forward, towards the young monk. "See," he said, "here upon my head there are the 5 scars." The young monk rose to his feet and gazed with profound interest at the hermit's skull. "Yes, the marks were there, each about 2 inches long, each still showing as a dead white depression." How fearsome, the young man thought, to have to undergo such an experience at the hands of females. Involuntarily, he shuddered, and sat down abruptly as though fearing an attack from the rear. The hermit continued, "I was not mollified by such an assurance. Instead, I asked, but why was I so abused by females? Are there no men if such treatment was imperative?" My captor, for so I regarded him, laughed anew and replied, "My dear man, do not be so stupidly prudish. Your nude body, as such, meant nothing to them. Here we all go naked most of the time when we are off duty. The body is the temple of the overself and so is pure. Those who are prudish have prurient thoughts. As for the women attending to you, that was their duty. They are nurses and have been trained in such work. But why cannot I move?" I asked, "and why am I not permitted to see? This is torture." "Apostrophe, you cannot move," he said, "because you might pull out the electrodes and injure yourself. Or you might injure our equipment. We are not permitting you to become too accustomed to sight again because when you leave here you will once more be blind and the more you use sight here the more you will forget the senses, tactile senses, which the blind develop. It would be torture if we gave you sight until you left, for then you would be helpless. You are here not for your pleasure, but to hear and see and be a repository of knowledge for another who will come along and who will take that knowledge from you. Normally this knowledge would be written, but we fear to start another of those sacred book or writings furores. from the knowledge you absorb, and later pass on, this will be written. In the meantime, remember you are here for our purpose, not yours. In the cave all was still, the old hermit paused before saying, "Let me pause for the nonce. I must rest a while."